Welcome to the West Highland Way Race Podcasts. I'm John Kinnistan, and this is episode 36. Over the past 2 weeks, we've had two inspiration nights. The first one was on the 12th of March in Edinburgh, and I didn't get along to that one, but I gather it was a really good evening and some great contribution from various folks. I'm hoping that there may be some audio that I can get hold of and put into a podcast, but at the moment I don't have anything from that evening. But on the 19th of March in Glasgow, I was there and I was able to record the various talks. So over the next two podcasts, I'm going to share those, and they're also on video, and they've been posted on the westharlemwayrace.org website with the slides as well. So you may want to download the slides so that you can follow the talk as you listen to that as well. But I thought for this podcast we would do Stan Bland. He did a talk on support, which was really helpful, and that lasts about 7 minutes or so. That was longer than that, 20 odd minutes I think, sorry. That Stan spoke about support and how to support your runner. And then the second part is Dr. Chris Ellis. Each year Chris gives a really helpful talk about various things that we need to watch out for in running a race of this length. So I've put that on. So hopefully this podcast will give a chance for those who didn't make it to the Inspiration Nights, either in Edinburgh or Glasgow, just to be able to catch up with things and to see how they went. So I hope you enjoy this podcast. And the next week's one will be the talk that I did, and then I also interviewed Rosie Bell and Paul Goeblin. So I'll put that on next week's podcast. So enjoy this week.
Great. Hopefully I've remembered how to switch a mic on. I think I have, given the feedback. One of the challenges in doing a talk like this is trying to cover all the things that the different perspectives from people in the audience will like. So I think I'm trying to cover a talk based on support for people who've done it more than once, for people who haven't done it, for people who might do it at some point in the future, for people who are going to support it. So the chances of me being able to cover in 15 minutes everything that you'd like to know and learn about are quite remote. So I'm going to throw it back to you in some regards and actually ask that you come up with questions. So make sure that you actually go away with answers to any questions that you may have. But my starting point this evening is actually going to be a quote, and I'm going to paraphrase it. And that's a quote made by Alan Kay. If anyone's watched the DVD Closing Distance, Alan's phrase has stuck with me for years and years and years. And he classifies race day as being, this is his time. This is the time which he can be selfish about. And he doesn't need to worry about what support are doing or where his support team are, because their job is quite simply to see that Alan gets safely from the start of the race to the finish of the race as efficiently as possible. So that ultimately is the essence about support. It's getting your runner from the start of the race to the end of the race. So where do we start from? And my first suggestion, and I'll put a question out to the people who've done it before, how do you pick your support team? What type of person do you look for? What qualities do they have? What special skills and knowledge do they have? Don't know what type of support. Does anyone get any ideas?
Take them to the pub.
Yeah. In fact, we'll come back to that. That's an important point.
Someone who knows the route.
Very valid point. What route? The running route or the driving route?
Both.
Absolutely. And we'll come on to both those points in particular. One of the things which stuck in memory is I was talking to a lady who's actually run the race 8 times. And for those people who've done the race before, it might be something you'd like to think about. She said when she first started running the way, as I said, she's done it 8 times, She thought that over the final few miles, probably from about White Corries onwards, that she actually wanted a support runner who would be quiet, who would be calm, who would be slow, because she would be so down by that time that she didn't want someone who would disturb her. And she discovered after five races that actually what she needed, as opposed to what she thinks she wanted, was completely different. What she actually needed was a support runner who was enthusiastic, who was noisy, who would constantly cheer up, who would constantly prod along. But she only discovered that after four races because she got in the company of another runner who had a support crew who were singing lewd rugby songs, and she got such a buzz from it that she actually found that she got on a lot better. So is what you need from a support runner actually what you need, just for those people who have done it many times before? There's another point about support team, and again, you know, we'll build up on this over the next 15 minutes, is you've got to be careful when you're looking for a support team that you don't go too far in the opposite direction. Classic case, a race we were at last year, 24-hour race, someone who had a support team who let them sleep for 6 hours. The phrase was, "But you look so cosy." Now, I'm sure some of you will know who that runner was. Yeah. You've got to guard against that. You've got to guard against picking support runners and support crew who really don't want to prod you along. You've got to guard against people who say, actually, okay, it's fine to sit there for 35 minutes. It doesn't matter. You know, as long as you finish. That's the key thing. You've got to be careful that you don't go too far the opposite way. So picking a support team is actually a bit more thought is required than many people would think about it. I've just discovered, of course, that one of the good things about bringing notes is you can refer to them. One of the bad things, you might need specs to read them. So if I suddenly go like that, it's because I'm trying to make out what I'm going to speak about. In terms of that, about knowing the route, 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, on the Friday morning, race day was the Saturday morning, I was sitting having coffee with a crowd of people who were doing the race, mix of support crews and runners, and we were going through all the potential issues that might come up, all the advice you could give people, and this one will live with me for many, many years. And I've been involved with the race. My first attempt at the West Highland race was 1986. I didn't finish, because I was part of the Bridge of Orkney. But anyway, crew constantly put their hand up asking questions because they were completely new to the race, they were new to the UK, they were new to Scotland. Support crew flew in from all over the globe that morning to support an American absolutely first-class runner, Mark O'Dale, who Adrian will know. And Mark's crew said to me, where is this, Arara Denon? Is that how you say it? I said, yeah, it's up here, I'll show you the map, don't worry about it. And where is Inverslade? Well, it's just a little bit further up. Okay, well, we're going to drive from Arara Denon to Inverslade, and then we're going to catch the car ferry. What? We're going to get the car ferry across the Ardlui, and then we're going to go up the A82. No, there isn't a car ferry. And at the rate Mark runs that, which is about 7 minute mile pace typically, he will be at Inverslade before you're halfway to driving around to Inverslade. So you're absolutely right in terms of knowing the route, both the running route and the driving route, your support crew need to be aware. So as we sit here this evening, how many of the people who are doing support actually know the route? Good. Because the next point, which I'll bring up getting completely out of order, was that one of the good things about knowing the route as a support crew is that when your runner's brains are completely frazzled, which happens about 12:50 on the Friday night or Saturday morning, it's about 10 minutes before the race, they've stopped taking any information in, their adrenaline is pumping through, they won't hear anything you say to them. From that point onwards, you have got to think for them. You've got to think in advance of them. So later on that day, when they get to King's House, you've got to be thinking, okay, you may need your head torch, because the runner will the runner's concentrating and just plodding on and doing the next section, you need to be thinking about what clothes will they need. You need to be thinking about what food have you taken. So it's very important that you actually make sure the support crew is fully aware of the route, as well as the driving route, the running route as well. And that leads me quite nicely on to how do you actually prepare a support crew. And the way I like to think about it is that you take the same approach as Formula One. You know what happens in Formula One? They've got an agreed schedule, they've got agreed pit stops, they have a race strategy, which you can go into in as much detail or as little detail as you like, but you should at least, I would suggest, think about it. So I'm sure we've got different approaches. I know some people have very detailed strategies which predict precisely what minute they expect to get into Bar Mahar, what they want to eat there, what shoe, you know, when they'll change their shoes, when they'll eat a banana, when they'll have some ambrosia or rice. Others a lot more flexible. But whatever you do, I would suggest to you that you consider having a pre-race briefing, and that you don't leave that till 10 o'clock on the Friday evening, which some people have done. The other thing which I've come across is the mad dash to Tesco's in Milngavie. It's quite close to the race start, and we haven't got any of this, that, and river. Enough, you see them piling in their cars off to Milngavie Tesco's to top up the supplies. So have a pre-race briefing. Suggestion after you have a pre-race briefing and worked out your timetables is who's going to do what. Now that sounds absolutely obvious, who's going to do what, but when you as a runner arrive into a checkpoint or wherever you've agreed to meet your support crew and you've got three or four people milling around, as often seems to be the case, you often find that there's lots of people doing nothing and the runner's sitting there getting a little bit frustrated because while he's eating his food, he's got to remind someone to fill up his water bottle, make sure his supplies are topped up. Whereas if you've discussed this beforehand, it's an awful lot easier. As you runner getting your food, someone's topping up your bottle, someone's making sure that you've got the kit that you require for the next leg in your gear, and off you go. It's back to the Formula One that's moving you on efficiently. Now that's easier to do if you have gone through the other point, and this really, I'm not good at, it's called organising your boot. When you get along to my car, it's in an awful mess. But if you organise your boot and know where your supplies are, giving it some thought beforehand, it does make life an awful lot easier on the day. Know what you're going to do with wet clothes. How many changes of clothes are you going to go through in the West Highway race? How many did you go through, Rosie? So one full set for people who didn't hear, and five different sets of top wear. Where are you going to put that in amongst the dry clothes? So you need to, you know, think about this type of issue. You should go through your briefing. From an organised team to organising your boot, slight deviation would be in terms of support. One of the things which is often forget, he says, putting his hand up, I've done this before, I usually leave this until about 2nd of June, is what are you going to do at the finish? Have you actually thought of where you're going to stay, do accommodation? What are your support team going to do? Because they often have different plans. Are they all party animals who are going to stay and hang around and go on to the party the next day? Or are they all going to rush back? So is this something to bring up? Okay, just check what I've got. Oh, yeah. In terms of allocation of roles, who's going to do what? One of the ones which was probably missed out before was making sure that the support team actually know the responsibilities at checkpoints. Who's going to check the runner out of the checkpoint? I think at White Corries a couple of years back, I know there were 19 runners who got to be checked out, so the race team didn't know where they were. if you could, when you're assigning responsibilities, make sure that someone knows exactly who is going to be telling the checkpoint marshals that you've left that checkpoint. And is it just one support team that you're having? Because frequently now people are splitting it into two, with someone doing the first half of the race and another crew doing the second half. But what happens then if you're going to have a handover? Because if you've got two support teams coming together, let's say Ocartyre, and the runner comes in and hasn't had sufficient to eat or drink on that last section, who's going to know about it? Because the new team inheriting the runner might think that everything's absolutely fine, and only later realise that there's a problem because they weren't made aware that the runner hasn't had much to eat or drink in the preceding leg. So how do you actually make that transition? How do you hand over one from the other? One team, which I saw do it very well, actually went as far as recording everything that their runner ate and drank every time they met him, and then actually physically handed over a piece of paper, which the second team then took. They knew exactly how well the runner was doing in the eating and drinking steps. So it's things like that that actually help your runner get to the finish. It's not just ability to run. If you're not taking in enough food and drink, you run out of energy and your runner will find it that much harder to keep going. So little things that you can do, everything which is at the margin, can help them get there, him or her, can help them get to the finish much, much more efficiently. So if you're going to have two teams, make sure you know where the transition is going to happen, how you're going to handle that transition, and be roughly sure when it will happen. And having looked at pre-race plan, having allocated responsibilities, having discussed what you'll eat and drink, and when you'll eat and drink, and where you'll change your shoes, be prepared for it all to fall flat in its face. Yeah, it won't happen. It certainly won't happen the way you plan it, and it certainly has never happened when I have planned it, when it should. Something will always go wrong. So what do you do? Panic. Don't panic. Even if your support crew, and if this is to the new runners, even if your support crew doesn't make it to the checkpoint or the support point, other support crews will be there. So to new runners, don't be shy about asking for help. My support team hasn't made it. There's been a delay. Can you help me out here? This race is probably the most friendly group of people you're likely to meet in a race. They just love helping each other out. So please don't be afraid of asking for help. Oh, a hard one here. Support ideally should know the runner. What do I mean by that? Well, what I mean by that is that it really helps if you know when to give your runner a hug. Or, as most frequently happened to me, give him abuse. I have found that all the support teams I have ever used have excelled at giving me abuse. Frequently I have been asked, what kept you? Didn't you know this was a race? You're not out for a gossip and a chat, you're out here to run a race. Know what works for your runner. And just as importantly, if not more so, it helps if your support crew know you sufficiently well to know when something's bothering you as a runner, when something's niggling away at you. Two folds. One, if it is just a niggle, they can sit you down for 5 minutes so you take your shoe off, get the stone out, and it doesn't become a blister which then bothers you for the whole race. And probably more importantly, as you're about to learn from Dr. Chris, is that you'll know when something's wrong and could potentially be a medical issue. But you've got to know your runner to do that. Now, Dr. Chris will give us lots of information, and I know there's lots of information on potential medical issues on the website. Support crew, it really does help if you're aware of that and know it. The only thing I would say is don't ever let a runner's mum know about it, because it'll terrify the life of it, and they won't let you run. So that's something else. My third bit of advice to support crew is never ever let your runner pull out until they have been through the wars at least three times. I know Daryl always used to talk about three times, Ian, didn't he? As a runner, for the way the first time, you will hit at least three lows of varying intensities for varying durations. You think as a runner that it's never ever going to end, but it does, usually. Usually. Not always, but usually. And sometimes the support crew can just calm the runner down, say, look, yeah, you're having a low spot, keep going, it will pass. And unless their two legs are broken or they're in danger of decapitating themselves, that's the only time that you suggest that your runner might not want to continue. So a bit of patience and knowledge goes a long, long way. I'll come back to what we said, runners are often brain dead. I don't know if that was in relation to the race or just a general comment. But whatever it was, it probably applies to me equally valid. Well, it does apply to me equally valid. The other little tip that I'd like to give runners and support crews is please know the race rules. You don't want to end up either jeopardising the race or threatening your runner from disqualification. I think everyone's well aware that the runner shouldn't be supported through ground foul, but be aware of the rules. The other one, which I know has caused some problems in the past, is support crews, I'm sure Ian will go on this at the end, about over abusing awkward tyre. You don't want an irate farmer jumping up and down complaining about his parking spaces. Now, the good thing is, that having said all that about support crews ideally knowing you, being able to run with you, knowing the running route, knowing the racing route, being prepared to go through a pre-race briefing, detail in various levels of detail exactly how they're going to help and assist you through the route, what we usually end up with is people who are willing to give up at least 2 days, if not 3 days, of their life, where they will put everything behind your efforts to see you finish the West Highland Way race and be completely selfless in doing so. And for doing so, what they're actually going to receive from the majority of runners is loads of abuse. They're going to see temper, they're going to see emotions, they're going to see anger. If you're really unlucky, you might see shoes thrown at you, as has happened on several occasions. I do remember, I think it was a water carrier being kicked at someone, but you know, that can happen, and they're going to ignore it. They're not going to abuse you back. They're not going to throw the shoes back at the runner. They're going to put up with it to help you get to the finish. But as a runner, you should be aware that they'll remember it, and they'll write it down, and they'll cast it up to you. And gosh, will you pay for it? You will, as a runner, you will pay for it. I think someone got a mini prize out of it once, but that's, I don't know if they ever got it. So, I think I'm coming to the end. I'm very, very happy to take questions.
We'll leave the questions to the end then.
We'll leave the questions to the end then. But I will finish with just one phrase. Enjoy. Support team that I have seen over the years have actually grown into great friendships, not just with other runners, but with other support crews. The camaraderie that exists in the race is not just about the runners. It's between support groups of different runners who come to know each other. You're going to be travelling 90-odd miles, in fact, I think by road it works out to about 104 or something like that. It's over 100 miles by road. You'll keep meeting the same faces from time to time. Hopefully you strike up friendships and enjoy each other's company. But it's actually a great, great race to be involved in. If you haven't done it before, I hope you go on to complete it and enjoy it as a team. Because as a runner, you won't complete it on your own. You need your support crew back you up and get you to the end. So with that,
I'll leave it. Thank you very much. So yeah, my name's Chris Ellison. I think I'll struggle to live up to that billing, but I'll do my best. Yes, as Ian said, I've been involved with this race since 2005, and my involvement in 2005 was substantially academic, because as far as I'm aware, that was your most hazardous year, with the most of the issues I'm about to speak about, when most of them happened. For some reason, I can't give an explanation, prior to that, the race seemed to have gone quite smoothly. and I hesitate to say, but since then, substantially, the race has gone quite smoothly. So I hope 2005 remains an exceptional year. But I don't think anyone need think that serious problems don't arise from long-distance running. And whether you think Pheidippides is fact or fiction, the concept that you can come a cropper from running a long way is clearly well established. And if you look at the cases on the right-hand side, that situation in events worldwide hasn't changed hugely. So I'm going to give you a whistle-stop tour through some of these things, not to try and put you off your thing, but you can't pretend that these things don't happen. So I'm going to categorize the events for tonight as per that slide there. But essentially, disorders affect your body generally, or they can affect a localized area. And in terms of the general disorders, I'm going to divide them into sudden death, which for all intents and purposes is sudden cardiac death, extreme variations of normal, which may look abnormal but probably aren't, and then abnormal conditions or disease states. And if I've got time, I'll mention some of the localized conditions, which aren't inconsequential, but are not at least life-threatening. So if we talk about sudden death, then, as I said, we're talking about sudden cardiac death, which is fortunately rare, but there have been some high-profile cases. There's two of them on there from recent times. And if you're interested in that kind of thing, broadly speaking, the causes of your sudden cardiac event are divided two ways, governed by your age. And if you're under 35, as per this unfortunate Cameroon footballer here, then if you have a sudden cardiac arrest, it's likely to be due to some hereditary cardiac defect. Obviously, there was a high-profile case recently, and I'm glad to say it is life. If you're over 35 and have a sudden cardiac event, it's because your arteries are clogged and you've had it follows a heart attack. So my recommendation there is if you know yourself to have... So, moving on from sudden cardiac death, we'll have a brief talk about the manifestations of extreme normality. And this is by far and away the commonest. The commonest significant problem that anyone looking after long-distance runners will encounter, which is, it's got its long fancy name, exercise-associated postural hypertension, but all it is a sudden fainting shortly after discontinuation of running. And the explanation is relatively simple, that blood is kept circulating by the pump of the active muscle, and then if you stop running, the muscle activity abruptly discontinues, and the circulation or the restoration of blood from the return of blood from the legs to the heart, pumping in the next heartbeat, doesn't happen and you faint. So there are certain requirements to make that condition. One is that you cross the line feeling well and have no symptoms prior to that. And the other is that this eventuality happens relatively shortly after completion. So if you collapse while you're exerting yourself, or if you collapse significantly after completion of exertion, then it's likely not to be this. But most people, if they're going to have this phenomenon, it happens within a few minutes of finishing running or completion of a stage. And if you spend any time near the finish, you'll see at least half a dozen of these every race, as you do in every long-distance run. And more of a meal is made of this than needs to be. Recognise that's what it is by the exclusion of any problem during the race, and leave the folk where they lie with their feet up and wait for them to come to you. So if that happens at the end of a stage, then there's no reason why the individual, once they've come to, can't get up and run on and proceed to the next stage. So the commonest thing, normal variation of physiology, under-recognized and over-treated. Here's another variation of normal, which is a rise in core temperature. Usually the people whose temperature rise like this are not even aware that it's happened. But as you can see from the figures there, which come from Bern 2006, the Singapore half marathon, quite a few of those runners by the end of the half marathon had temperatures, core temperatures over 40 degrees, which you might think was a feature of heat stroke. But there's more to heat stroke, as you'll hear later, than just a rise in temperature. So these are people whose core temperatures have risen and are quite well. Now, you're less likely to encounter that in the West Highland Way race because the ingredients required to raise the core temperature are, first of all, the bulk of the athlete, and I accept that most West Highland Way runners are bigger than the average Singaporean. So that contributes to temperature rising. But against the temperature rising in the West Highland Way race, first of all, the temperate Scottish climate, and secondly, that the intensity of effort, because you are running for more than 30 hours, the intensity of effort at any one time is less. So you're unlikely to see those rises in core temperatures that you might see in a half marathon runner in Singapore. But the take-home message is that your core temperature can rise as part of the normal response to running, and it's of no disease significance. The next variation of normal is muscle breakdown. So in 2009, three of us measured the muscle breakdown enzyme, creatine kinase, CK, of 67 finishers who finished quite well. Now the cutoff for normal creatine kinase is 200. So as you can see, every single finisher had a significantly raised creatine kinase, and yet they were all well. So, and this phenomenon has been described in other races. So, a degree of breakdown of your muscles is universal in every finisher, and I've now got used to that. And if that's all you've got, and there are no problems associated with it, then I call that a variation of normal, and I'm now no longer bothered. But if you return whence you came to your city GP, and you go on a Monday morning feeling a bit rough, and he draws some blood off you and sees that you have a creatine kinase of 130,000, he will be very uncomfortable. Okay. But I'm happy to take calls, because if nothing else is wrong, and you've got the understandable aches and pains of having done what you've done, and the only biochemical abnormality is a high CK, and it takes some weeks for that to settle down to normal, then I don't think that's any big deal. So once again, I put rhabdomyolysis without complications on my list. The last of the normal variants is weight loss. A certain amount of loss of weight during the event is common, and I hazard to say that it's normal. So I expect most people to lose some weight, and here are the weight changes of that same 66 finishers from 2009. And as you can see, the best fit line for 66 people's weight loss is just below 2%. So does that graph make sense to people? I just plotted the weight loss, percent weight loss down that side there, everybody who finished, and you can see that the best fit line sits just below 2%. And that corresponds with what people report elsewhere. And I think that's normal, as do most others. And then we'll move on. And I hesitate to say that not only is it normal, it's also desirable. So if you plot weight loss against finishing time, whether it's the West Highland Way race in 2009 or South Africa Ironman 2001 and 2002, you'll see that if you plot weight loss against finishing time, those people who lose the most weight have the shortest finishing time, i.e. finish the quickest. I'm slightly holding back from recommending that you lose weight in order to do well. So I'm cautious with my wording. But if you stay with me for the rest of the talk, you'll appreciate that I think weight takes care of itself. You just drink what you feel you need to drink, and weight will do what weight will do, and I think you will be fine. So I don't think people down at this end in the West Highland Way race or that in South Africa Ironman were consciously fluid depleting themselves. They drank what they felt they needed based on thirst. They lost weight, they didn't come to any harm, and substantially had decent finishing time. So weight loss is normal. Weight loss may be desirable in that it's associated with a favorable finishing time. And weight loss is protective. I'm sorry that the direction of the weight change, i.e. the weight gainers and the weight losers, is the opposite way around from the previous graph. And I'm sorry there's so much writing on it. But I'll just bring your attention to this mass of dots here, which is most people. And as you can see, these are Noakes' figures from Cape Town. that he regards people whose weight changes between no change and 3% loss as normally hydrated. So he doesn't consider you are dehydrated until you, for the purposes of this graph, until you've lost 3% of your starting weight. So that, I hope that supports what I've said, that essentially a loss between 2 and 4% of weight is normal. So he doesn't consider that you start to become dehydrated until you're 3% down on your starting weight. And as you can see, this great wedge of people who lose from their starting weight and straddle the new hydration, normal hydration, dehydration line, also maintain normal sodium. Okay, so weight loss is normal. Weight loss seems to be associated with a better finishing time, and the degree of weight loss is associated with protection of normal sodium levels. So, on the subject of sodium levels, we've moved on, we've spoken about sudden death, we've spoken about variations in normal, and I'm now going to finish off talking about disease states. So when your sodium level drops to below 135, that then becomes an abnormal situation. And it's important that you appreciate that the cause for a sodium falling is not because you've sweated salt, okay? It's because you've ingested and retained too much fluid. And that makes the prevention of a low sodium substantially in your own hands, and it's governed by your fluid drinking schedule. So recommend that you heed that and drink by thirst rather than any sense of so much time has passed and therefore you have to imbibe so much fluid. The problem with the low sodium is that the symptoms initially, is that the sodium is only mildly low, the symptoms are themselves mild. But as the sodium tumbles below 130, then the symptom progression moves on from confusion, fits, coma, and death. There are a few others, but that's the progression, and there have been a few deaths from this. It happens. 13% of runners in the Boston Marathon were found to have low sodiums, although fortunately, in the majority of them, the degree of depression and sodium wasn't so great as to make them particularly unwell. There's a group of risk factors which dispose you to developing a low sodium, of which the main one is drinking more than you need. So if you drink more than you need, gain weight, you're female, you're one of the slower runners, and it's an event which lasts more than 4 hours, which clearly the West Highland Way race does, and you're consuming anti-inflammatory medications, those are a hodgepodge of risk factors which dispose to the development of EAH. As I've mentioned, it's substantially avoidable. I don't give any guarantees, but if you remain in the category of weight losers, around that 3% mark, stay off the anti-inflammatories, and maybe monitor your weight during the race, then your chances of avoidance of a disease state low sodium are good. Although we've said 13% in the Boston Marathon, countries where they are more signed up to the fluid restriction side of things, like New Zealand and South Africa, the incidence is lower. So here are some finishing sodiums from the 2009 West Highland Way race. And if you remember, normal sodium is between 135 and 145. You'll see that there are no low sodiums in the West Highland Way finishers of 2009, apart from that one. And what you can't tell from that, because it isn't shown, but what I know is that we measured everyone's electrolytes before the start of the race, and that same runner had a low sodium there. So I can't remember what the reason for the low sodium was, but it wasn't anything to do with the race. So if you take that one out, because it's not a fudge, that one is not an EAH, that everybody's sodium was above the lower limit of normal. We've got one or two whose sodium is slightly above the upper limit of normal, four high sodiums, and that's of no consequence. So if you compare that with the same study done from 47 finishers, study done by a friend and colleague in the United States on the Western States Endurance Run, can you see that the average sodium is significantly lower in an American run than it is in the West Highland Way race? This is not the time and place to explain why I think those differences exist, although I hope one of the reasons for the difference is evenings like this. So I'll give you the message and you do what you're told. Okay, So the next disease state is complicated rhabdomyolysis. So I mentioned that everybody's muscles break down to some degree and they have the raised muscle enzyme that we can easily measure. But most of the time they get away with that. Occasionally you don't. The breakdown products of muscle get into your kidneys and clog your kidneys up to an extent that they don't work. So that the urine output can diminish, weight goes up, you feel rotten, and if you do further blood tests on these people, then you can demonstrate an accumulation of things that the kidneys ordinarily eliminate. Now, we've had two of those in the West Highland race in my time, one in 2005, the other in 2007, and they don't normally come to light until some hours after the race, when people become aware they don't feel very well, maybe being sick, aren't passing urine, and if a day has gone by, the weight will be increased. And the problem is, a day after the race, you may not be in the company of people who know anything about these conditions. And I don't think it's an insult to my profession to say if you trot along on the Monday morning and see your GP, it may not be the first thing you think of. So if you notice that your urine is down, or your volume is down, or it's this chocolate colour from the breakdown products of the muscles, feeling generally rotten. It may be up to you to persuade whoever's looking after you to do whatever blood tests are needed, and they're very simple, to check that your kidneys are working fine. So it doesn't come to light quite as quickly as the low sodium, which can declare itself during the race or very shortly afterwards. But in 2005, the two folk who fitted as a result of low sodium, one was just after withdrawal from the race, towards the end, but not at the very end, and one was just after finishing. And that's usual. Okay? This low sodium present relatively early with regard to the race, and the kidney injury from rhabdomyolysis presents a bit later. So you may be out of my hands by then. Oh, I didn't mention an important thing. But this is less preventable than the low sodium. But there is no doubt there is an association between the consumption of anti-inflammatory painkillers and the development of kidney injury with rhabdomyolysis. So for that reason, whatever your aches and pains, it would be inconsistent for me to give you an anti-inflammatory, and therefore they're nowhere to be seen, and certainly from my perspective, during the course of the race. So if you've got any aches and pains, I'm afraid you just have to endure them or take some paracetamol. But you won't get ibuprofen or diclofenac or naproxen or Ponstan from me. And I plead with you not to take them yourselves either. If you look at all the cases of acute kidney injury with rhabdomyolysis in our own two cases and other people's, the incidence of concomitant taking of anti-inflammatory medications is high. And it's undoubtedly a risk factor. Heat stroke. So I mentioned that your temperature can rise, and if that's not associated with any other symptoms, that's normal rise in temperature. But if your temperature rises and you are unwell, then that raises the question of heat stroke, of which I've no great experience and I've never seen, and I hope I never do. I did in my hospital days do some time in anaesthetics where a very similar condition can arise following exposure to certain drugs. And although I used to rehearse how I would deal with that, I was lucky enough not to see it then either. So I've no great experience of heat stroke. All I can tell you is that if you're unlucky, it can happen. If you're hot and you're knocked off up top, then you're in for some cooling. As you can see on this last statement here, you need a high suspicion and you need to get in there early and implement cooling early. The problem is if you do that aggressively and the individual then becomes well, you can't know whether that person was heading for heat stroke or not. But I'd rather remain ignorant as to what they were heading for than watch them cook and then find things are too late to turn them around. So I and my ilk generally be aggressive with cooling. If we think it's needed, accepting that we probably do cool more people than we need to. So that's the end of what I have to say about the generalized disorders, sudden cardiac death, extreme variants of normal and disease states. I'm just going to mention a couple of localized conditions, of which this one is probably the biggest worry. But occasionally, if you've used a muscle group excessively, the muscle will swell, and the muscle is contained within a sinew, or fascia, and therefore the you get developed pressure on the nerve and artery, which is also within that sinew, and the muscles themselves can become damaged in a way that's irreversible. So the cardinal symptom of this is pain greater than can be explained by any other reason, and it doesn't go away, and you have to suspect early and cut the sinew surgically. I wouldn't do that, but I'd find someone who would, and release the problem and try and prevent substantial degrees of muscle damage and compression on the nerve and artery. So if you develop a pain in a muscle, within a muscle, which is greater than you can explain from your endeavours, then it may be this. I've never seen a case of this from the race. I've heard of a case from another race, and I've seen a case of it from a non-running, one case ever from a non-running course. The first thing to do if you suspect it is to remove any circumferential bandage or dressing, and that can help a few. But if that doesn't work, then it's a surgical decompression that's needed on an emergency basis. You may know more about these than me, but prolonged exertion can be associated with bone stress, and that bone stress can culminate in fracture. And with runners, the two commonest sites are the shin bone and the one of the bones of the foot, the metatarsal. Can you see those? Thereby find a way the two commonest sites of stress fracture. I see a lot of those, and I've seen two of these, kind of spreading redness in the shin. And I can't explain why that happens. Two of them ended up in hospital with the hospital diagnosis of cellulitis, which is infection or inflammation of the cells, soft tissue infection, if you like. It's hard to say exactly what that phenomenon is, but it's clear, for those who get it, the two that I've encountered who've had it, it's quite debilitating, such that they've ended up in hospital and they've settled down on painkillers and antibiotics. But I can't explain why that happens. Unfortunately, not terribly common. So, I wind up here. These are my conclusions. Read the guidelines, and that's for the runners and the crew. Drink by thirst rather than any schedule. Avoid the anti-inflammatories. Monitor your weight. I'm not overly fussed about weight as long as you are well. But if you are unwell, then I'll take what's happened to your weight into consideration and I'll guide you in what I think and do. There are folk who get a bit worried that if they've gained weight, given that the rules say that I need to know if you've gained weight, then I might pull you out. But if you've gained weight and you are well, then that is of no consequence. If you've gained weight and you are unwell, it points to me as to why you might be unwell. So weight gain alone will not result in you being pulled out of the race. And again, if you lose weight more than 4% and are well, neither will that result in you being pulled out of the race. They're just pointers to help me interpret other things. You hear this condition bandied about. I don't know what it is. You get hot, for reasons I've explained, and you get tired because you've run a long way. How that culminates in a condition called heat exhaustion, I'm not sure. So I don't know what that is, but you see the term banned in my language. People who don't deal with these events very often presume that everybody who's unwell is dehydrated, and hope you've seen enough to know that that's not the case. That's a slightly dangerous assumption, and is usually wrong, because from that they then proceed to tell you to drink copiously, and that can exacerbate other things. So if you're going to diagnose dehydration, mean it, you know why you're diagnosing it. If you have to go and see somebody after the event because you're not well, take a copy of the guidelines and a pee sample and try and steer whoever's looking after you in a direction of doing the things that are on those guidelines. Jump up and down and get some blood tests or get your backup member to do it. And I certainly wouldn't be pouring fluids intravenously into anybody until I know what the electrolytes, particularly the sodium, are doing. So that's me. I hope you haven't been bombarded with long words that you don't understand, and I'll take any questions. Yes? Sorry, I couldn't speak up. Yeah. Okay? If you follow the reasoning, then the reason why sodium drops is not because you're deficient in sodium, either deficiency that might arise either from dietary source or sweat loss. The reason why the sodium falls is because you've diluted it with excessive water. So if you follow that logic and you accept it, and that's obviously up to you, it's an invitation for me to do so, but I can't compel you to, then sodium supplementation isn't required, and it's not just me who says that. Yeah. The if you venture the other side of the Atlantic, that's probably the only place in the world where the role of sweat sodium loss is thought to be significant. And from that, they extrapolate that you should take sodium supplementation. And I hope the demonstration of the sodium levels of the finishers of the Western States Endurance Run show the consequences of their strategy. I can't badmouth American colleagues, but I can show you American sodiums. I hope that's persuasive. So in answer to your question, sodium supplementation for the West Highland Way race, not required. If you were to take things on and do something completely ridiculous that went on for weeks, I might have to revise that statement. But for 35 hours, you're good with your current sodium stores. Yep. If you're well, you're well. As you saw from the South African Ironman figures, there's someone there who lost 12% from the starting weight. So it seems to be not overly dangerous, but I'm not advocating that. All I can say is that losing 4% is safe. Beyond that, it may not be, but the odds are still in your favour. Are you a weight loser when you run? I don't think I've seen more than 6 or 7% loss in a finisher, and it followed the trend of what I showed you, I think it was a German guy who either won or did very well. He lost 6 or 7% and was right at the forefront of the field. So you see the pattern that folk who lose a lot of weight tend to be the hares out in the front, and that tends to be what you see. And by virtue of the fact they're running as they are, I'm relatively reassured that they're quite well. I mean, I take each case on its merits, but I haven't had to deal with someone who's lost 10% of their starting weight. So I hesitate to say there is no harmful degree of weight loss, but I haven't seen it so far. Yep. Kidney injury, yeah. I think it's an exertional thing, and it goes in there with the muscle breakdown. The problem is, as I've demonstrated, that everyone gets a degree of muscle breakdown, and from that, a large number of people with muscle breakdown, a small number of acute kidney injuries develop. And I could give you some give you some explanations as to why I think that happens. But as far as I'm aware, it's not genetic. I've told you the single biggest risk factor is the consumption of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. I don't know of any genetic disposition. Okay, and if you weren't running the race and you took your ibuprofen recommended dose for a short period of time, you would not get a kidney injury. I know as a GP that we try not to have people on anti-inflammatories, anybody on long-term anti-inflammatories, and the potential for them to be toxic to the kidneys, even at prescribed dose, is there, and that's one of the reasons why we try not to have people on the long term. So the non-steroidals can be damaging to the kidneys, even at prescribed and recommended dose, in people who don't run. But the combination of a hard run with the rhabdomyolysis that goes with it, and even a small number of non-steroidals over the duration of the race, can promote an acute kidney injury. But I don't think it's genetic. Good.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Go on. See you later. Yeah.
That's just quick.
Can you experience some swelling in the fingers?
Yeah.
Can you tell me what that suggests and how you can sort it out? If you can sort it
out. Okay. I think that's pretty universal. state, unless it's part of swelling generally, weight gain, bit knocked offness, which is heading down the hyponatremia route. But if your only symptom is swelling of your fingers and you're well and your weight is between that 2% and 4% weight loss, I think that's an innocent consequence of just gravity, the fluid making its way down to your extremities, and the thrusting down of your arm, which kind of forces fluid into your fingers. And I suspect many people who've done prolonged exertion will recognise that symptom, which appears kind of confined to the fingertips. Well, you're more honest than me. People identify with that swelling feeling in fingers?
Yeah.
I think that's normal, and I haven't got any strategies to stop it happening. If you're swelling generally, that's not abnormal. I need to see.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to thank Chris again, not just for tonight, but obviously for his involvement in the race, and it makes a massive difference to us. So, round of applause. Thank you very much. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of West Highland Weight Race Podcast. Lots of good information there from Stan and Chris. And as I say, next week there'll be the other talks that were on from the Glasgow Inspiration Night. I'm recording this on Saturday, the 23rd of March, and it's in the afternoon, 4:20, and quite a few people are running. There's two big races on that I'm aware of this weekend that I've been following. One is the Hardmoor's 55 race, and that should be, the leaders should have finished by now, and others will be coming in soon. And then the other one is the Thames 100 mile race, which West Highland Way runner Debs is involved in. So I think the latest I heard after the first checkpoint was that Debs was in first women's place, and eighth overall. So I'm looking forward to following how that goes. So if you're out running, I hope you're having a good run. Katrina and myself with Ryan are running from Tyndrum to Fort William tomorrow, and look out here at Paisley, and there's lots of snow. I'm not quite sure what it'd be like on the route, but I'm sure there'll be some snow. So looking forward to a good run tomorrow. So hope you've enjoyed this podcast, and remember, slow and steady wins the race. I'm going to go to the hospital.